Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and wild habitat on the Southern Kenai Peninsula. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. For this episode, we talk about compost with Jody Anderson of University of Alaska Fairbanks, who serves as the director of the Matanuska Experimental Farm and Research Center. We chat with Michael Hicks, owner of Grandpa's Worm Castings, about vermiculture. Kyra Wagner and Matt James of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District have our Tech Minute, and Nicola Revelo tells us about current events happening in local agriculture. Okay, let me test this out. Could you just say a couple things?
Sure, a couple things.
Great, that's great. I've heard that you are the compost queen. I'm wondering if you could introduce yourself.
Sure. That's quite a title. My name is Jody Anderson. I work for University of Alaska Fairbanks as the director of the Matanuska Experiment Farm and Extension Center here in Palmer, Alaska. I've worked on composting research, specifically looking at developing a recipe for fish and cardboard composting. Knowing that fish and cardboard are two waste products that we have pretty much all over the state, and they're excellent feedstocks for composting. So I worked on that research a little bit, and unfortunately funding was cut before I got my answers. So
in general, could you describe an ideal compost pile?
It'll look like a pile of straw or a pile of leaves, and it will have no odor and no one will notice it. That is ideal compost pile. Let's see, like if you were to dig inside of the pile and kind of look at what it's made of, it will be about three parts carbon to one part nitrogen. It'll be about 50 to 60% moisture, and it'll have a high rate of oxygenation. So that means that there's lots of pore spaces. There's lots of opportunities for oxygen to be in the pile. So it's kind of a fluffy pile. It's not super drippy wet. As the pile gets older, you recognize less and less what the feedstocks were. So the feedstocks are what you build your pile with, and then as the bacteria and fungus do their work and break down the carbon and the nitrogen, they decompose that material and it looks less and less like what it started looking like. So if you had lots of food scraps, maybe even some sawdust and some straw, possibly maybe some old hay, and you were to mix all of that together for your compost, right at the beginning of your pile, it's going to look like what you built it from. However, as time goes on and you turn it and the pile works like it's supposed to, the ideal pile will ultimately end up looking very similar to soil, and there'll be very little recognizable from the original feedstock.
So you mentioned that the ideal compost contains three parts carbon and one part nitrogen. What are some things that you would add that would qualify as carbon?
So carbon products in the composting world are often referred to as browns, like the color brown. That's deceptive because not all brown things are carbon. But in general, carbon are going to be items that are lots of old plant material. So things like dried hay, maybe grass clippings, but after they've been given some time to sit and lose the green, because the green contains nitrogen. So once the grass clippings have turned brown, those can be used as a brown. Dried leaves, sticks, twigs, cardboard, newspaper, office paper. You'll want to shred all of those things because you don't want just sheets of paper in there. And then also things like sawdust, maybe even like chainsaw residual. And then sometimes you're even going to have bigger, kind of larger pieces of wood, like wood chips. And those are more what's called a bulking agent. They don't really break down in the pile, but they're there to create pockets of air. And so sometimes you'll need those as well. But it's hard to find in Alaska. I know that sounds weird, but for building a compost pile, carbon's hard to get sometimes because we have, you know, communities, especially out west and up north, that don't have lawns that they mow, don't have trees which lose their leaves in the fall time, and, you know, don't have easily found hay or straw. So carbon can be difficult, but cardboard certainly is a good carbon source. It does tend to turn into oatmeal. So you'll want to add lots of bulking agents, lots of kind of wood chips to your pile if you're using a lot of cardboard. But carbon is usually going to be the one thing that you really need to pull together as you're building that pile, because you need three parts of it to every one part of nitrogen. So three times as much carbon as nitrogen. And that's a lot. I mean, it really is, especially if you're looking at large piles of compost. And then on the other side is the nitrogen, which you need about one part to. And the nitrogen is, in the composting world, for people who look this up online, will find it listed as greens. But that's not necessarily also correct. There are a lot of not green things that are nitrogen rich. But nitrogen in your pile oftentimes comes from food scraps, fresh mowed grass, like really fresh grass. Coffee grounds are excellent nitrogen source. Manures are nitrogen sources. Usually those aren't green. So using the term coloring, the greens and browns is kind of deceptive, but just think of animal products, if you will, or just living products that are still green are excellent nitrogen sources. Also, spent grain can be used as a nitrogen source, and you can find spent grain. Most of your breweries or distilleries will usually allow you to get some spent grain, so you can throw that in your pile as well. So really, carbon and nitrogen are the main pieces to this recipe, and that's about the science to it.
Well, I'm wondering if we could get just a little bit more into the science. I've been trying to understand a little bit about the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle. How do carbon and nitrogen interact within the compost pile?
Oh, great question. This is the science part that I really love, that most people are scared of. what you're doing in a compost pile is you're actually a zookeeper for the microbes that are doing the work for you. So composting is a natural biological process that happens everywhere on the surface of the earth, and it's the process of decomposition. But humans wanted to do it faster and better than the natural process. So by making piles and manipulating the process, we've come up with this system called composting. And really all we're doing is manipulating a natural system. And that natural system is you have bacteria and fungus who are responsible for breaking down dead material on the surface of the earth. And the magical thing about compost is you don't need to add any inoculants to your pile. And you also don't need like a sourdough starter type concept. You don't need old compost from another pile to start a new compost pile. All the bacteria that you need to allow composting to happen are already where they're supposed to be. So what you're doing in a compost pile is you are feeding these aerobic bacteria. So they like oxygen, they need oxygen. To feed them, just like any living thing, carbon is our energy source. So these little microbes go through cellular respiration, just like the mitochondria in human cells do. With the help of oxygen, we break down sugar and it gives us energy. And that's what the bacteria are doing in a compost pile. So you're feeding the carbon, they're eating the carbon for energy, just like we eat carbon for energy. And as all living things have proteins and amino acids, which are the base of all proteins, are built of nitrogen. And so in order for the microbes to grow and reproduce, they have to have nitrogen in their diet in order to allow them to go through their metabolic and kind of living lives. And so without the right amount of carbon or the right amount of nitrogen, those microbes will either compensate by eating something else, or they will just stop and they will wait until the situation gets better. So what you're doing in a compost pile is you're feeding your microbes the carbon and the nitrogen that they need. And that's kind of what that recipe, that three parts to one part. And the water is necessary, as all living things need water. And the oxygen is required because these little dudes need to break down the carbon into energy, and they use oxygen to do that. So as a composter, you are a zookeeper and you are giving these microbes everything they need so they can do their job, which is to decompose and break down this waste material into something that you can use in your gardens later.
So as a zookeeper, you have to water the compost. You have to feed it by adding oxygen, feed it by adding more organic matter.
Actually, you're going to start the pile with all the food that they will need. So you're not going to add to the pile. You will turn it, which will allow more oxygen to come in, and you will water it exactly like you said. But hopefully you've built your pile correctly in that you've given it all of the food it's going to need for the whole process.
I know that people take temperature readings of their compost pile. Are they looking for an ideal temperature?
Well, they might be, because over 130 degrees is when you start to kill the E. coli, kind of the bad bacteria, the Salmonella and the E. coli, and some of your weed seeds start to die. But mostly what people are doing is they're measuring the temperature of the inside of the pile, and as soon as the temperature starts to decrease, the microbes in your pile are like little children in a room with no windows, but you give them lots of candy and puppies and you let them run around, and all that energy that those kids are expelling create a lot of heat. And that's exactly what's happening in your compost pile. Those microbes are eating that carbon, and they're eating the easy carbon first. So these are the sugars. And so those bacteria are super, super active, and they're actually releasing, they're creating energy, and that energy is in the form of heat. So your pile will heat. And then as the food source becomes less available, then the bugs, I call them bugs, but the bacteria, they start to slow down. And because, just like little children in a room that get all hot and sweaty, when they start to slow down, eventually the temperature of the room is going to start dropping as well. And that's what happens in your compost pile. That's your sign, the composter's sign, the zookeeper's sign. It's time to turn your pile. So a good composter is going to monitor the temperature of their pile, and they're going to actively turn it as soon as the temperature starts to fall, because that tells them that their active bugs in the middle of their pile aren't getting enough food anymore and they're starting to slow down. So by turning the pile, you're bringing in food from other parts of the pile into the center. That's kind of where the action happens. And you're also going to water it while you turn it. And you're also allowing new oxygen, reinvigorating it with oxygen as well. So it's kind of a restart button. The temperature will go back up again, and then it'll fall again. And it will keep doing that until you turn it and it doesn't increase in temperature anymore. And that can be, you know, 60 to 90 days, depending on how well you've babysat your pile. Once it stops changing its temperature, once the temperature stops increasing after you've turned it, then you're done composting. So people who compost, who are taking the temperature of their pile, probably have a little nerd streak in them, which is awesome. And they're monitoring when to turn and when not to turn, would be my guess.
And so after the compost gets to, you know, a temperature, a lower temperature, and everything that's active is stopped, can you use it? I mean, you said 60 to 90 days. That seems really fast.
It is. It is really fast. And that's assuming that we've taken really good care of it. Most of us end up, life happens and we forget, and then it turns into a pile of goo, but it's okay. After it's finished composting, this is when people start throwing things at me. This is where you put the pile away and you let it cure. You just let it sit. Now it's not actively composting, and you're not going to turn it anymore. You're not going to water it. You're not the zookeeper anymore, but it is a pile that needs to be left alone, because now is when the fungus comes in. They're like the marathon runners of the carbon eating world, and your bacteria are your sprinters. Once composting is finished, all of that easy carbon is gone. And what's left is really long chain carbons, very complex carbons. And that's when fungus comes in and they start breaking that down. And that's when you get really beneficial qualities of the compost beyond it just being organic matter that you're adding to your soil. But then you're also adding a really nice pile that's been broken down even further. You'll have fungal spores in the pile. You'll have some antibiotic qualities, because that's what fungus is all about. And so there's some benefits to allowing your pile to cure. And you're also just making sure that it is totally done composting. And then it's recommended that you let it cure for about a year, which is painful for most people up here, but you'll end up with better results with your compost the longer you let it cure.
This might be a kind of Western question, but is there anything that I can just instantly use as compost?
That is a Western question. Well, the thing is that when you start just adding raw materials to your soil instead of composting it, what you're doing is you're throwing off that carbon and nitrogen balance in your soil, because these bacteria are doing the same thing in the soil and in your garden and your flower beds and all the things. And so if you throw a bunch of wood in there for, like, let's say mulch, the bacteria in your soil, they're going to want to break that down. It's a carbon source. They're really excited about it. And they start breaking it down, and they've got lots of food, and they start looking around. I'm anthropomorphizing, of course, but they start looking around for nitrogen. And there's no excess, there's not a lot of nitrogen just sitting around. And what those bacteria will do is they will start pulling nitrogen out of the soil that is really, you put it there for your plants. And so anytime your bacteria, your soil microbes are competing with your plants for nutrients, your soil microbes win. So by adding just straight nitrogen or just straight carbon to your soil, there are benefits to it, but you're also throwing off the balance of your living component of your soil because you're giving it too much of one thing. So there is no quick fix. Certainly there are better things that you could add than others, but yeah, bunny manure is a good kind of fast one. Coffee grounds are good. Things that are on the nitrogen heavy side, but still have a lot of carbon in them. So like spent grain, this sounds really weird, but heavily vegetated manures. So like rabbit manure, like pelletized, right? Like moose pellets, right? That would be better than from... yeah, like a chicken.
I'm wondering if we can play a little game. And this is where I would ask, one, can it be composted? And two, is it carbon or is it nitrogen?
Okay, this will be a fun game. I'll have to really think on this. But yeah, let's play.
Okay, wood ash, like wood from my stove.
Wood ash is neither. Wood ash is going to add micronutrients to your pile. It also is going to add added salts to your pile because wood ash is a salt concentration. So I usually recommend people add wood ash kind of towards the end of the composting situation or even during the curing process. And the reason is the wood ash doesn't really contribute to the process of composting at all, but it does lend excellent micronutrients to your plants. So you'll want that in the material that you're going to put on the plants at the end. But it really doesn't contribute carbon or nitrogen to your pile, and it doesn't speed up or slow down the pile at all.
Okay, how about horsetail?
Horsetail, those evil equisetum. So horsetail, if you pull them and they're green, they're going to be a nitrogen. And they will break down rather quickly because they're a pretty simple carbon. So those would be fine in your pile. The problem is if your pile doesn't get hot enough or you don't compost completely, you may be spreading horsetail in your own gardens, but you know, that's a chance you get to take later, I guess.
Okay, how about urine?
Urine adds urea, so it's a nitrogen. It adds salts to your pile, and it also adds water. So it can be a nitrogen contribution, and also just knowing that it's adding extra salts, but also moisture as well.
And are salts something that I want to avoid in my compost?
Well, the process of composting is actually going to concentrate salts to begin with, because as the bacteria consume the carbon and they use up the nitrogen, they consume the nitrogen, and they're using the water. You know, any salts that are in the liquid at all will be left behind and they'll be concentrated. So adding extra salts to your pile is just increasing that salt content. And keeping in mind that there are plants that are very saline sensitive is just something you'll have to pay attention to. And you're also going to make sure that you don't ever plant in 100% compost. You're going to always want to cut that compost with native soil because it's going to add to the soil, but you don't need so much of it that it takes the place of the soil. So you always want to look at 60-40, 60 parts or percent soil and 40 compost. And then you're not going to really run into problems with salts, concentrated salts. But, you know, just watch your plants. They'll tell you if they're too salty or not.
Okay, just a few more. Can I put it in a compost questions? Blood.
Oh, yeah, actually, you know, especially if you've just finished cleaning fish or, you know, something to that effect, pouring that in, it is a nitrogen source. And it's also moisture. So two positive things there.
Okay, one of my favorite chickens just recently died. Can I compost her?
Yes, you can. And the concept is called carcass composting. When you carcass compost, you're going to want higher amounts of carbon. And the way to do that is you layer your pile. There are many farms in the lower 48 who have taken on carcass composting as a way to get rid of and dispose of appropriately their on-farm deaths, livestock death. And so they actually are doing carcass composting on site. And you want to start with carbon, like a big layer of carbon, like maybe 12 inches, 8 to 12 inches of carbon. And then put your chicken to rest on that bed of carbon. Add a little bit more nitrogen to that layer, like around the chicken, and then cover her with another thick layer of carbon and a little bit of nitrogen, and then the whole pile in carbon. It's called carbon capping. But yeah, you can totally compost carcasses, and they work fine. In Maine, they actually composted a whale. And it was pretty slick. So yes, you can compost a chicken.
I know that I can use my kitchen scraps, but are there any kitchen scraps that you wouldn't recommend putting in a compost pile?
Well, for first timers, everybody always says like no dairy, no meat, and that sort of thing. And it's not because you can't compost it. It's because most people don't compost properly, so it turns into a really gross pile. But I would say that if you follow directions well and you cover your pile with lots of carbon so it looks like just a big old pile of leaves or straw, then I would say that anything in the kitchen is good. A couple things to remember is that we do have cooler temperatures, and so our bacterial processes are a little bit slower sometimes than, say, in the lower 48. And so you might not get rid of, let's say, all of your eggshells. They won't all decompose or compost in the first round. You know, other skins like orange peels and that sort of thing, those might be slow, but most things in the kitchen are good to go.
You had mentioned that the compost heats up. Have there ever been compost fires?
No, because what happens is in order for it to get hot enough for a fire, it would have to be anaerobic. And most of the times, the reason the pile is anaerobic is it's too wet and there's not enough space for oxygen. All the spaces that oxygen would be sitting in are filled with water and it's flooded. So you end up with an anaerobic pile and it's so wet, it will never catch on fire, but it will smell horrible and you'll know something's wrong.
So I've seen a lot of products being sold that are vessels for compost or compost turning. Do you recommend these, or am I okay with just a pile in the yard?
I think that a pile in the yard is your best bet, only because what happens to people who have compost turners and vessels is that they drop their food scraps into it, and then they drop their food scraps into it, and then they drop their food scraps into it, and they never add enough carbon. So a couple things are happening. One, they don't have the right balance of carbon to nitrogen, and so they end up with nasty, stinky nitrogen sitting there waiting to be consumed because there's not enough carbon for the bacteria to be there and do their thing. And the other thing that's happening is that every time you add to your pile, like your vessel, you're starting from day zero once again. So anything that kind of makes us lazy in the sense that, you know, we just keep adding to it every day, unless it's constantly turning and has a great carbon source in it, I would say that it's better to just have a pile in the backyard.
So those are all my questions. Is there anything that I have missed or anything that maybe you feel like you would like to talk about a little bit more?
Just the one thing is that because composting is a natural process and it is about 10% science and about 90% art, it's very much like cooking in the sense that there is a recipe and you'll tweak the recipe because you'll know your feedstocks and your recipe may be different than my recipe, but in the end, it's all ends up being compost. And so it's very much like cooking in that you just practice and the art comes in the practice part. And so a good composter is all about trial and error and seeing what works and what doesn't. If people are interested, they could look at Cooperative Extension. I do work for them, that might work. But one of the best resources out there is Cornell University has a waste management research site, and they have amazing resources.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for your great questions. I really appreciate it, and it's been a pleasure.
And that was Jody Anderson with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Matanuska Experimental Farm and Research Center, recorded June 8th, 2021. Coming up next, we talk to the owner of Grandpa's Worm Castings about vermiculture.
Okay, so my name is Michael Hicks. I live in Kasiloff, and I own a business called Grandpa's. Our slogan is Grandpa's Got Worms. And we sell worm castings, which is the primary business of vermiculture. I've lived in Alaska since 1995, and I've got several other interests. But today we're talking about vermiculture. Vermiculture is the manual farming or raising of worms for our own benefit. When my kids were little, about 10 to 12 years old, I had three of them, I challenged them to think of their own business. We went through those and I helped them on the internet to figure out what it would take to do that. And I offered that I would fund the startup, but it would be their business. They'd have to do the work. I had a son that we did chickens. I had another one we did pheasants and built incubators and learned how to incubate and hatch those pheasants. But my daughter wanted to do worms. We could not figure out how to raise worms without killing them all or running up a huge electric bill for heat. And it birthed out of that. It took me about 10 years to kind of figure out a way to do it. And then we dug out our basement, added 1,200 square foot onto the house because we just had a crawl space, dug it out to 10 feet, put in floor heat, and really built it for that business. Initially, it was to raise worms, but it ended up turning into vermiculture for worm castings. So we don't sell worms. They're our best workers. They work dirt cheap. But we sell the castings.
Is this your primary business?
No, it's not. I'm a pastor. I pastor New Life Christian Fellowship in Kasilof. I also have an oyster farm over in Peterson Bay across Kachemak Bay. And so those three keep me pretty busy.
Is there a difference between the actual word vermiculture and vermicompost?
Yes. Well, vermiculture is just the raising of worms for human benefit. Vermicompost, I would differentiate that vermicompost from vermicastings. Castings is just a polite way of saying worm poop. And so the castings are is after the worms have eaten the dirt, have eaten the organic matter, they've digested it, and they excrete these little castings. And we double sift all of our stuff so that we end up with pure castings, 100% castings. That's different than vermicompost. If we were to sift, say, with a larger sift and only do it once, we would end up with castings, but we'd also end up with some organic matter that's not decomposed yet. That would be vermicompost. And we do also make that, although it's a byproduct. We make it at about 25% for the castings. Right now we're producing about 40 yards, cubic yards, of castings, pure castings. And out of that we'll also produce an excess of 5, 6, 7 yards of vermicompost, just as a byproduct. We don't sell that on the open market. We've got one customer that takes all of that. They'll take more if we can make it, so we don't bother marketing that one, as I can't produce enough to supply any further demand at this point.
Why do people use worm castings? What are the benefits?
So actually there's quite a few. And well, let me say one thing. The primary difference between vermicastings and vermicompost, or any other compost, is in castings there are no pathogens. So the benefit with the castings, the biggest benefit in my mind, is the microbes themselves. In testing healthy soils, one of the primary ways is how many microbes per gram of soil. And that measurement goes from 1 to 5 million. And in your Missouri River bottom, which is some of the richest soils in the United States, they test up in the 5 million range. They're just way up the top. Worm castings test as high as 100 million microbes per gram, up to 20 times your Missouri River bottom, because the worm castings are the primary source of those microbes, even in Missouri. We've got peonies farmers down there in Homer that have told me that they take crab shells, oyster shells, other seashells, and they grind them up and add them to their soil. And typically they would be 3 years before they'd look in that soil and they wouldn't find bits and pieces of the shell anymore. And yet they started using the castings, and by the end of the season, there's no trace of the shells. They just are that aggressive with breaking down whatever is in the soil that can be broken down, both vegetable matter and minerals.
So how do you use the castings? Do you just sprinkle them on your garden plot?
We've got several that use it in different ways. So if somebody is planting small plants, they'd go into their garden and they would dig holes and prepare those holes that they're going to put the plants in. And so with those, which what they would do typically is they would mix the worm castings at 10 to 20% with their whatever their soil mix is. So depending on what they're planting, they might use something, a loamy soil with good drainage, have something that they would add in there for nitrogen. And some of the examples would be bone meal or blood meal. There's the one out there that's SEAG is a good one. But you want to put a nitrogen source in that soil and then add 10% castings and just mix it in. So those castings, when you put it in that soil, pack it around there and wet it, those castings will instantly start breaking down the nitrogen. And they have their own nitrogen source also that will feed plants, even young plants, up to 3 to 6 months, depending on the plant. So typically when you're planting in the ground like that, you would mix it with your soil that you're packing in. If you're seeding, then typically what people will do is they'll spread the castings out, and you can spread it just like you would a fertilizer. Put it in a seed spreader, fertilizer spreader, spread it over your soil, rake it in a little bit, put your seeds out, and then start watering. Water right away. Probably the best way that that we recommend is that in the fall, when you're putting your garden away, that you'd clean it all up, you'd add your nitrogen or whatever you're going to be put in for amendments, till that into the soil, let it sit through the winter, and then in the spring before you plant, go ahead and spread your castings over it. Doesn't have to be deep, just a light covering, and then you rake that in a little bit and water it. And those microbes will go right to work, and then go ahead and plant that whole patch. Wherever you plant it, you're going to be in good soil. We bag up all our casting. We sell it by the cubic yard to all the retailers, and then they sell it. But they've got it in half cubic foot bags and 1 cubic foot bags. When you open that up, the bags are sealed so that they don't dry out, because the two things that'll kill the microbes is direct sunlight or drying out too much. We get our castings down to just under 15% moisture level, and then we seal them in bags so that it doesn't go down from that. Between 10 and 15%, the microbes become inactive. And so when you pick up our bags, you'll see some bags that have been shrunken together like a mummy. It's like all the air is sucked out of it super tight. And that's because the microbes are still active when we sealed it, and they sucked all the air out. And then they become inactive. You mix that in, add water. And as soon as you add water, then those microbes come right back, just like yeast.
So where is this product sold in Homer?
Homer, we've got the wagon wheel. Steve over there carries our product.
There are underwriters.
Shout out to Steve. You betcha. I love their thing over there. Go over and get stuff from them. Also, Panama Reds over there carries the worm castings. Also, Fishy Pete up there in Anchor Point Greenhouse carries it in your area. If you're up further north, Cadre carries it in Soldotna. Panama Reds has a store in Kenai that carries it. Alaska Mill and Feed is doing distribution throughout the rest of the state. And we've got a few customers up in Fairbanks that we ship directly up to.
Can I ask you some questions about the worms themselves? What kind of worms are these? Is it a specific species?
It is. It's a nightcrawler. So right now in the United States, I was looking this up earlier, and I think they said there was over 300 species of worms in the United States, indigenous to the United States. In Alaska, they were, I believe the number was closer to 40. And there's some debate as to whether they're indigenous or not. But there are currently, you know, there's your red worms, there's your wigglers, there are night crawlers in Alaska. Even up here in the Soldotna Kenai area, particularly, and I know there's a lot of night crawlers down there in Homer. You get in some of those grass areas. But in any case, we use night crawlers primarily because they turn over. So we make our bedding. We don't use compost material. We don't use leftover vegetables or anything else. We have a very specific grain mix that Alaska Mill and Feed mills up for us. The problem we've had, we want worms that are going to turn the dirt over quickly and create castings. The night crawlers do that best. But night crawlers in captivity are a problem. There's a lot of ways to kill them besides drowning them. pH is a concern. We found that protein poisoning is a major concern with night crawlers if they're in captivity. If the ground becomes toxic, they can't move away from it. And we're raising our worms in containers, in buckets. So pH will kill them. Too much protein in the grain will kill them. So we have a grain mix that we have specially milled up for us, all Alaska grains. If they don't have enough water, then they die off. We've got quite a few things. We've played with them for about 4 years before we stopped killing them and figured out, got the wheel made so we could actually raise them without having huge die-offs.
You've kept worms for quite a bit. How long do the worms live, and do you mate them?
They have a life span of about 2 years. If you keep them very, very moist, you'll get up to that 2-year span. We don't, because if we kept them that moist, we'd have a very hard time separating the castings. So we've got to keep them moist enough to stay healthy, still dry enough to be able to separate the castings every cycle. And for us, a cycle is 2 weeks. So we've got 2.5 gallon buckets and put our worms in there with fresh bedding. And 2 weeks later, that bucket of bedding is about 90% castings. And so we run it through a sifter, a double sifter, that separates those castings from the hatch. The hatch are eggs. And so they have both female and male reproductive organs, and that's in the collar, that collar that's around their neck. When they become mature, they have that collar, and that's actually where the reproductive organs are. And so, yes, we'll take from that hatch, we'll take out some each on each cycle, and we run those through, and it takes about 4.5 months before they are big enough that we can start sifting them again. Before that 4.5, they're just so small they would fall through the sifter. And so we've got a different process that we use with them until they get to a big enough size that we can add them to production.
So what you're saying is worms are hermaphroditic.
Yep. Well, I think it actually takes two of them to produce. I know it does, to produce eggs, but worms have both the male and female organs in them.
Can they choose their sex?
No, they are both at all times. So a worm attaches, and you know, if you look at them closely, in that collar, they have a male organ that will connect into the female organ of the other worm, and the other worm is doing the exact same thing, has a male organ that's connecting into the female organ of the other worm. Strange as that sounds.
But, oh, it's fascinating.
So I've gone through my list of questions. What am I missing?
Well, there's a few things that I hear questions of and we deal with. You can also use this for your lawns and spread the castings just like you would a fertilizer. You always want to, when you apply castings, you always want to water right away. Because again, if they dry out, you're going to kill the microbes. You get the water in them and the microbes will start multiplying and they'll follow the water down into the soil. Another thing is as an exfoliate spray. So an exfoliate is something that you spray onto your plants when they're showing signs of disease. So you'll get plants that'll get different bacterial infections, their leaves will start to decay away and whatnot, and it's a bacterial infection that's eating at the plant itself. You can take the castings and make what they call worm tea, and you spray it onto your plants. And what it has is you've multiplied your microbes in a water-based container. You'll get the microbes that just multiply throughout it, and you get this heady foam on it like a root beer, and that's when you know it's done. But you take that water and you can spray it onto your plants, and what it'll do is it'll scrub your plants. The microbes on the leaves and the stems and everything will eat all the bacteria. It'll eat the dead plant material and clean it up. It's a real good way of treating your plants and keeping them healthy, especially if you've got a favorite house plants that have been having trouble. The worm tea, I brought that up. There are a number of people that use their worm teas just for feeding their plants. I've used it. I've got a great big greenhouse that's got fruit trees. And we used it for the first 2 years of our fruit trees when they were only a year old. And after 2 years, our fruit trees were the same size as your typical five-year fruit tree. They're just huge. But a worm tea is, you mix it one cup of castings to every gallon of water, or a quart of castings to 5 gallons of water. We've got one customer that does it in drums, 55-gallon drums. But anyhow, you would take one quart of castings to a 5 gallon of water. You would add in 1 tablespoon of unsulfured molasses. And it's very important to be unsulfured. Sulfur will kill the microbes. And then you put an aerator. You let it be at room temperature, which ideal is about 70 degrees. Put a small aerator in there like you would use in a fish tank, just something to blow bubbles in there. And that, between 24 to 72 hours, you know, that will develop a big foamy head on it. And at that point, it's ready. Those microbes have eaten that molasses as their primary food source and just multiplied throughout there to such an extent that you've got this big foamy head. Now you can use that water to water your plants, to water your lawn, to water your trees, or as an exfoliate on your plants.
So if I make this tea, does it have to be out of the direct sunlight or kept in a dark place?
Not necessarily dark, but you do want to shade it.
As far as your business goes, Grandpa's Got Worms?
Grandpa's. The slogan name's Grandpa's Got Worms, like got milk. My grandkids think that's hilarious.
Are you one of the few people doing this in Alaska?
No, we're the only one doing it in Alaska. There was one other, and I understand quite a few years ago before we started, because we started back in 2009, didn't start marketing it until 2014. It took that long before we stopped killing them. But we've been marketing them since 2014. There was one person during that time that was trying it, and they were having trouble getting past the point of killing the worms. There's another person that tried it up in Fairbanks, and I was trying to help them with that, but he was having the same problem, and he gave that up last year, again, just with large worm kill-offs. And it's in every area. You've got a few things to watch for, but in every area, you've got to tweak it and find what works, and then stay real careful to that, because it's surprising how easy it is to kill worms, you know, and then it takes 6 months to get your worm population back to where you're back in business. So that's a big setback.
Besides some of the problems that you had mentioned before, are there any issues regarding the worms that are specific to Alaska or our environment up north?
Issues. I know that the guy up north in Fairbanks was trying to use wigglers. And the thing is, you get up north and they really don't even have wigglers. The soil's just so cold during the winter that the worms don't survive. Most of the worms that we have in Alaska are coastal, just because of the more moderate climate. Yeah, you start getting interior and we just don't even have them. They've got to bring them in there. But the wigglers are a little bit of a problem in that they're so slow. Digestive systems are so extremely slow that you've got to have a huge quantity of wigglers in order to actually, you know, produce the castings on any kind of commercial level. So that's why we don't use them. We did find out that little tiny wiggler, and they are small, but if you grain feed them for about a year, they get really fat. About an inch long and almost as thick as a pencil. And they don't move much. All they do is roll over. So anyhow, the wigglers are able to get big.
So is there anything else that you wanted to say?
One other thing is I mentioned the humus quality of castings, that they hold a great deal of water. That is something to keep in mind. You don't ever want to use castings at 100% or even 50%. And so really, you're looking at small amounts of castings. You're primarily using it just to inject these microbes into the soil and add water, and the microbes will start to multiply as long as there's a nitrogen source there for them to eat, whether it be dead plant material or whatever the source is.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet. You bet. My pleasure.
And that was Michael Hicks, recorded June 8th, 2021. You can find out more about his operation at grandpasgotworms.com. Coming up next, Kyra Wagner and Matt James have your Tech Minute.
Hello, this is Kyra Wagner from Homer Soil and Water for today's Tech Minute. And today we're going to be talking about the mysterious compost bin. It's not just that you make a pile with a bunch of things in your backyard. There are plenty of options for encasing it, making it beautiful, making it functional, and making it part of your yardscape. So a lot of people get a little bit excited when they see all these commercials for a compost barrel on a track that you can just turn and it all composts for you and it's all easy and you never have to lift a pitchfork, you never have to hurt your back turning it. And my fellow Alaskans, I'm going to warn you that we have too cold of a climate to really get anything kicking in one of those compost barrels. I've seen a lot of people purchase them and then sit in the back of the yard as a piece of junk later, because no compost decomposes very fast in those kind of little compost bins. The barrels are very cute, but they're often too small. One of the first rules of composting is to make it big enough so that you can get that warm core center going. And so it's always suggested around here that you at least build a pile that's 3 by 3 by 3. So if you're going to build a compost bin for your compost, make sure it's not a commercial barrel that's only a couple feet around. If you build something larger than that, I have seen some very creative barrels homemade that do function and can turn and not break your back. But you know, compost isn't that heavy. You can also throw your chickens into your compost bin. If you have a chicken yard nearby and they can have an entrance into your compost bin, they can turn it for you. That's a great tip. But if you want to build your own compost bin, do take a few things into consideration. You're going to want to make sure that it doesn't get too wet, and yet you do want it to be able to receive some rain. If you put solid walls on it, it won't be able to breathe, so it does need access to air. So this is one of the main reasons so many people use the common pallet for a compost bin, building a few sides out of pallets and then leaving the front open or with a gate on it so that you can pitchfork in and out of your compost bin. And that's one of the big topics too, is you have to have it in multiple locations. Just one bin is a little bit more difficult when it comes time to spin and aerate and flip that compost. So if you have two bins right next to each other, if it's made out of pallets, you could have your openings right next to each other. You can flip from one into the other. So they're both contained. They can both fluff up into a large pile inside that pallet-sized bin, and you'll have enough air, you'll have enough moisture, and you'll have enough size and depth to get that warmth and get those microbes heating up in the center of your compost pile. So there are lots of ways to build them, and it just so happens that I have my coworker Matt James from Homer Soil and Water here with us today. Matt, tell us about your favorite home style technique.
Yeah, thanks, Kyra. A really neat and nifty way to build one of these bins is just to use a simple wire fencing, like a lot of folks use around to protect their trees from the moose here locally. You can get some wire fencing that's about 5 feet tall. Just simply build a cage that you can fill your compost inside of it, and that gives you the aeration and the exposure to the oxygen that you're looking for, and keeps it contained and at a nice depth level that where you can get that heating to go on that Kyra was talking about. It makes it very easy when it's time to flip your compost. You can simply unwire the cage, pull it out from around the compost pile there, and you just simply reform the cage right next to it and then flip your pile right back into the empty cage. That's a pretty easy way of doing it. And I also recommend folks put a tarp over their pile so it's easier to control the moisture levels in your pile as well. And that would be my tips for just a simple composting setup.
Perfect. That is our Tech Minute today from Kyra and Matt down at Homer Soil and Water.
That's the show. I want to thank Jody Anderson and Michael Hicks for talking to us about compost and vermiculture. Homer Soil and Water Conservation for providing our Tech Minute. Nicole Arevalo for staying up late and helping me edit. Unfortunately, we didn't have time for her segment. You can find it on KBBI's website along with this full episode. I want to thank the local band Trial and Terror. You can find their music on Bandcamp. They provided the music for this show. Questions, comments, corrections can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.